It is Friday, August the 25th. This is VOA's International Edition. Many thanks for joining us today. Coming up, could the U.S. send lethal weapons to Ukraine?
We're not exactly clear on what President Trump will decide to do and how he will interpret it. And I think that President Poroshenko is just trying to do as much as he can to cultivate the United States relationship to get more aid.
Angola's ruling party leads in this week's election. Islamic State holding civilians as human shields. Also, the power and scope of social media and a new film from Hollywood. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. U.S. Defense Chief Jim Mattis, during a visit to Ukraine, said Russia is, in his words, seeking to redraw international borders by force. He also said U.S. sanctions against Russia will remain in place until the government in Moscow changes its behavior. Mattis spoke alongside Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko after a meeting in Kiev. My colleague Sarah Williams spoke with VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb about comments from Secretary Mattis.
Secretary Mattis said that the United States will not accept Russia's seizure of Crimea. And he also said that despite Russia's denials, the United States knows that they are seeking to redraw these borders, as you said. He said it was undermining the free and sovereign nations of Europe, and he vowed that the United States would support Ukraine in this. Now, when you talk about supporting Ukraine, there are lots of ways you can support Ukraine, and one of those ways that has been circling around here is the possibility of providing lethal weapons to Ukrainian forces. The secretary was asked, would the United States do this? President Obama did not and chose not to. But Secretary Mattis said that the United States was actively reviewing that possibility. And now that he has been to Ukraine and seen the current situation, he can inform the president with very specific terms for the direction ahead.
Did Ukrainian President Poroshenko have any comments about Mr. Mattis's remarks?
Well, the Ukrainians in general have wanted more and more support with even lethal weapons. The problem with it on the United States side, however, is that there are two camps, essentially. There's the one camp that feels like it is morally right to provide Ukrainians with the tools that they need to support themselves and protect themselves from what is clearly determined by many is Russian aggression. There is another camp, however, that acknowledges this point, but then worries that providing such weapons would provoke Russia and escalate the conflict further, causing even more Ukrainians to die. So it puts the United States in a very difficult position. And so whereas President Obama said, okay, it's going to be counterproductive if more people die, we're not exactly clear on what President Trump will decide to do and how he will interpret it. And I think that President Poroshenko is just trying to do as much as he can to cultivate the United States relationship to get more aid.
Well, in other Pentagon news, the Wall Street Journal is reporting that the White House is going to be giving the Pentagon guidance on implementing President Trump's order to ban transgender people serving in the military. What have Defense Department officials said about this today?
I actually just got off the phone with another official who said that the Pentagon has not received any guidance. They have heard of the so-called memos, but nothing has actually trickled down to the Pentagon. And until they get that guidance, there is no change to the Pentagon's current policy. I know that the White House has said that there are tremendous medical costs and disruption that transgenders in the military cause. There are others. There's a petition going out that I've been told about with more than 200,000 signatures since this Trump tweet came out saying that it does not do so and that the majority of transgenders in the military do not undergo the surgery that Trump is tweeting about that costs so much money. So there's clearly a lot of arguments going on, and I think the focus of this that Trump tweeted on would be on the deployability of the troops. If you are transgender, but you can deploy just like any other service member, there should not be any reason for you not serving in the military. I don't think that Secretary Mattis would be for that. So we're going to have to see in the coming days, after the memo turns into actual recommendations to the Pentagon, what is going to come out of it.
That is VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb speaking with VOA's Sarah Williams. Also in the news, Angola's Electoral Commission says the country's ruling party took a strong lead in early election results. The People's Movement for the Liberation of Angola has so far won just over 64% of the vote from Wednesday's poll. We get an update now from VOA's Anita Powell in the capital, Luanda, Angola, who spoke with the host of African News Tonight, Kim Lewis.
What they did show was something quite extraordinary. The ruling MPLA party won in every single one of the 18 provinces that they have announced results for. That's all of the provinces. And they won by fairly large margins.
I understand that, though, there was something very unique that occurred in Luanda.
The exception to this pretty uniform route was the crown jewel, which was the province of Luanda, which has about 6 million people and 2 million voters. Here in Luanda, that's the capital, the MPLA, the ruling party, won just over 50%. And 34% went to UNITA, which is the largest opposition party, and just under 14% went to CASASE, which is another opposition coalition that is very popular in the capital. So this does present a challenge to the ruling party in that here in the capital, where a lot of citizens see both the largesse, both the wealth of the ruling party, the wealth of the officials who have ruled Luanda for so long and are living in poverty, they're going to expect results, and they are going to be much more critical of their government, which could lead to friction in the future. The other thing I wanted to say is that, as you know, the opposition UNITA party said that they were going to do their own vote count, as did the opposition CASASE party. I just spoke to a spokesman for the UNITA party, and he disputed the election results. He says UNITA is doing their own count. He also said that the parties are going to demonstrate, didn't give any specifics on that, but he said, however, that he encourages everybody to stay calm, to maintain peace with these results, although the opposition has made very clear that they are not happy and they do not believe this to be a legitimate reflection of voters' will.
If they do their own count, what will that mean?
By definition, the only official vote count is the one that I just gave you, which is that from the National Electoral Commission. That's the only recognized count, and that's the mechanism by which this election has been conducted. The only count that I guess one could officially take to the bank is the National Electoral Commission count. The opposition counts are just in tandem with that. These are their own counts based on their own polling data. They say that they've seen different results and they've done better than these official results indicate, which casts many doubts over the electoral process.
With these latest results just being released, what are people saying about it so far?
It's taken them about 5 hours in the National Election Commission to tell us this. So most of the capital journalists have been cooped up in one place. What I can tell you is that here in Luanda, especially in the poorer neighborhoods that were very opposition-oriented, people are expectant and they're a bit nervous. And this news of pretty widespread ruling party victory in the country, this is probably going to be met with disapproval. To zoom out to the entire country, countrywide, the ruling MPLA won about 64%. And together, UNITA and CASASE, which are the two largest opposition parties, 24% and 8.5% respectively, which means that it's still about a two-thirds, one-third situation. That gives the ruling party still a lot of power.
That is VOA's Anita Powell in the Angolan capital, Luanda. She was speaking with Kim Lewis, who's host of the VOA program Africa News Tonight. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter, every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Savor the flavor of African music. Hi, I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
Says VOA's International Edition, Yemen's former president Ali Abdullah Saleh rallied thousands of his supporters in the capital Sana'a, marking the 35th anniversary of the founding of his General People's Congress Party. Show of support follows a recent rift with his Houthi rebel allies. Friction with the Houthis continues and threatens to tear apart the alliance that has been battling forces loyal to the exiled president, who is Abu Rabu Mansur Hadi, and a Saudi-led coalition. Edward Uranian is in our bureau in Cairo following the story.
The gathering of support for former President Saleh took place peacefully in Sana'a's Miden Sabain Square, despite recent tension between the veteran leader's party and his Houthi rebel allies, who remain the most powerful military force in Yemen. Saleh alluded to putting the thousands of military men still loyal to him into the conflict that has racked the country since the Houthis arrested internationally backed President Abdurrabu Mansur Hadi in 2015, eventually forcing him to flee. The Houthis have been battling a Saudi-led coalition that intervened in March 2015 to support Hadi. Yemen analyst Hakim al-Masmari tells VOA that Thursday's rally failed to change the political equation in the country, and the Houthis continue to hold the advantage for the next round of political dialogue scheduled for September under the auspices of the United Nations. Saleh, nevertheless, he believes, remains a force to be reckoned with in the country.
He is the most powerful person in the country when it comes to social support. But when it comes to power on the ground, military power, the Houthis are the most powerful. Militarily, he is very far behind the Houthis.
A recent disagreement between Saleh and the Houthis erupted after the former president referred to the Houthis as a two-bit militia. But in his address to supporters Thursday, he directed most of his criticism to President Hadi and his Saudi allies. Saleh says his own supporters have made many sacrifices to defend the revolution that brought him to power in 1978 in what was then North Yemen. He says the ongoing war is tearing the country apart, blaming what he calls the traitorous and treacherous leadership under Hadi outside the country. The Houthi militia avoided a potential conflict with the former president and his supporters, despite talk in the media of declaring a state of emergency and forbidding political rallies like the one Thursday. A speech by Houthi leader Abdel Malik al-Houthi to his supporters earlier this week, in which he criticized Saleh, suggested a potential conflict was brewing between the two men. He says his forces have been stabbed in the back by their allies, despite the many sacrifices they have made at a time when they are fighting to stop the enemy aggression. Political alliances in Yemen are fickle, and Saleh's forces have fought the Houthi rebels six times since 2004, before forming an alliance after he fell out with his one-time deputy, Hadi. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
A senior United Nations official is warning some 20,000 civilians held hostage by the Islamic State in the Syrian city of Raqqa are in great danger, and everything possible must be done, he says, to help keep them and help them escape, that is. Lisa Schlein reporting from the UN in Geneva.
The special advisor to the UN Special Envoy for Syria, Jan Egeland, Thursday said the needs of thousands of civilians trapped in five Raqqa neighborhoods under Islamic State control are beyond belief. Egeland voices concern about their lack of protection as the military offensive to retake the Syrian city from IS intensifies. He says civilians are suffering large casualties from heavy shelling by the Syria government and the constant air raids by the U.S.-backed coalition forces.
There seem to be no real escape for these civilians. I cannot think of a worse place on earth now than in these five neighborhoods for these 20,000 people.
Egeland says the UN is urging the humanitarian task force, including members of the coalition fighting to retake Raqqa, to do whatever is possible to help people escape the embattled city.
People that come out can not risk air raids when they come and where they come. Is this the time when you also announce a humanitarian pause, which we did for many other places, including in Aleppo and elsewhere?
Egeland acknowledges the difficulties of enacting a humanitarian pause in the fighting to allow the civilians to flee. He says that is mainly because the UN has no negotiating partner in Raqqa, IS's self-declared capital. Unlike other areas, such as Aleppo, where it has been possible to achieve a pause, he says the UN has no contact with Islamic State fighters who are deliberately using the civilians as human shields. According to rights group Amnesty International, hundreds of people have been killed or injured since the offensive to retake Raqqa from Islamic State began in June. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Here in the U.S. this week, President Trump has appealed for a more unified nation. A unity speech came on the same day. A new opinion poll showed that nearly two-thirds of Americans believe Mr. Trump is doing more to divide the country than bring it together. Also this week, the president delivered a divisive speech in Phoenix, Arizona, lashing out at the media again for its coverage of his response to the violence at a recent protest organized by neo-Nazis and white supremacists in Charlottesville, Virginia.
So I'm condemning the strongest possible terms, egregious display, hatred, bigotry, and violence. Okay, I think you can't do much better, right? Okay, but they didn't want to put this on. They had it on initially, but then when they talked, he didn't say it fast enough. He didn't do it on time. Why did it take a day? He must be a racist. It took a day.
President Trump was broadly criticized for blaming both sides for the violence in Charlottesville, where a 32-year-old woman was killed when a man associated with the white nationalists plowed his car into a crowd of counter-protesters. In Germany, where the Nazi symbol, the swastika, is banned, a group of graffiti activists have taken it upon themselves to transform that symbol of hate into something beautiful and positive. We get the story now from VOA's Faith Lapidus.
When Berlin's graffiti artists need supplies to express their thoughts on walls around the city, many come here. Ibo Omari runs the Legacy Art Supply Store and the Cultural Heirs Youth Club, a forum for young artists to exchange ideas on how to use art as a weapon against hate messages and symbols like the swastika.
It was important to spur young people into action and to encourage them to take responsibility so they don't just ignorantly walk past such symbols of hatred. Rather, inform the owner or those responsible that a hateful symbol is emblazoned on the wall, and that puts them under pressure to remove it. When they don't do that, we offer our help and say, we would like to beautify it. In all cases, without exception, we got the permission and agreement of the owner or those responsible and could beautify it without involving the bureaucratic process.
In 2015, a man came into Omari's shop for some spray paint to cover a swastika in a park where his son was playing. 2 weeks later, Omari says he was shocked to hear about more swastikas painted in a skate park. That's what motivated him. 16-year-old Philip is one of the young artists in Omari's Paint Back initiative. He's involved because he believes racism has no place in his country.
When tourists come to Berlin and look at a wall and see a swastika, they'll think, what's going on here? There are Nazis everywhere, and we don't want that. An artistic symbol obviously looks much nicer than an ugly message, and then people walk through the city with a smile on their faces.
A promotional video for the Paint Back initiative highlights some of the 25 swastikas in Berlin the group has transformed. The program is now being copied in other German cities. For writer Faiza El-Masri, I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
And now it's time to find out what's trending on social media with International Edition's Andrew Palchevsky.
Today, we're looking at two stories that demonstrate the power and scope of social media. And we start with the largest social network out there, Facebook, and some insights into how they're working to stop would-be terrorists, spammers, racists, and other people looking to use social media to do harm. Alex Stamos is Facebook's chief security officer, and he announced on Wednesday that Facebook removes more than 1 million accounts per day that violate their terms of service. Now, even despite that massive number, he says that Facebook still struggles to keep up. They simply can't catch everybody who breaks their rules. The opposite is also true. In some cases, they remove content that's perfectly fine to post. Stamos acknowledged that Facebook does make mistakes, but they do try to fix them. But 1 million accounts per day gives you an idea not just of how many people are trying to do bad things on social media, but just the scope and number of people using Facebook. In fact, Facebook worldwide has over 2 billion monthly active users. It's a massive network that stretches all over the globe, so perhaps it's not surprising that people are trying to use it to do harm. But at least now we know that Facebook is cracking down. And earlier this week in the U.S. state of Missouri, we saw how social media can be used to fight for justice. Now, back in 2001, a man named Marcellus Williams was convicted of murdering a newspaper reporter and was sentenced to death. But in the years since, there have been questions about the evidence in this case. Some say that Williams was convicted for a crime that he did not commit. With his execution date approaching this week, people began flooding the Instagram account of Missouri Governor Eric Greitens. On Greitens' posts, regardless of the content, people would leave comments asking him to delay Williams' execution and look into the case. That effort then spilled into Twitter and Facebook, where a petition to the governor received hundreds of thousands of signatures. And before long, Williams' name was a trending topic. Well, just before the execution date this week, Governor Greitens decided to delay Williams' execution to allow for further investigation into the case. Activists say that social media played a huge role in raising attention to this case, delaying the execution, and, they now say, potentially saving a man who may end up being innocent.
International Edition's Andrew Palchevsky. You can follow Andrew on Twitter if you'd like, at APAL. I'm on Twitter as well, at VOA Norman, and our program, International Edition, can be found at VOA_IE. This is VOA.
This is BizBeat.
A robotic arm controls a 2,000-degree flame being used to test a jet engine part. The sort of job Herbie Mays used to do at a 3M plant in Milford, Ohio. The company moved to Mexico to cut costs, and Mays is out of a job. Not just because of cheap Mexican labor, but because of robotics. The flip side, there are lots of manufacturers hiring in the U.S. and abroad, but they require different skills. 37-year-old A.J. Sherman is an apprentice learning to be a mechatronics technician at a plant in Virginia Beach.
When I tell someone I'm an apprentice, the first thing they ask is, do you make money? And the answer is obviously yes, we make great money.
A new age of new workers like 18-year-old Jalen Britton, who studied robotics in high school and has been training as an apprentice at Duke Energy.
But really the robots, they're going to enhance what we're already doing.
And not a victim of automation, but a beneficiary. For VOA's BizBeat, I'm Philip Alexio.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. Well, there's a new film out there that looks at the true story of Colin Warner. He's a Trinidadian immigrant who was wrongly convicted of murder and spent 21 years in prison. VOA's David Byrd tells us about the film Crown Heights.
Colin, I want you to know that I believe in your innocence. It's hard to accept that I don't have the power to take you out of there. That the best thing I can hope for is peace of mind.
Colin Warner was just 18 when 16-year-old Mario Hamilton was gunned down on Flatbush Avenue in Brooklyn, New York. Two other teenagers were interrogated about the crime, and the only witness to it picked Warner out of a mug book. But Colin Warner was nowhere near the crime when it occurred. Despite a lack of evidence, Warner was arrested and found guilty, despite being told by another man that he had actually committed the crime. In the new film Crown Heights, Lakeith Stanfield plays Colin Warner. Stanfield says he did a lot of research to prepare for the role.
Matt Ruskin, the director, gave me a big bag of like books and footage and court transcripts and hearing transcripts, so I had a lot at my disposal. I also got a chance to hang out with Colin Warner and meet his family, and they blessed me at a shrine in their house, so I got to be very intimate with them, which was a really great treat.
Namdi Asomugha plays Carl King, Colin Warner's childhood friend who fought for his exoneration. Asomugha says even though Warner's story is a tough one, the film does show the power of the human spirit.
There's this uplifting part in this film that's really inspirational and really shows the value of friendship and love, and I think it all plays together.
After 21 years in prison, Colin Warner was exonerated and released. Crown Heights was screened at this year's Sundance Film Festival and won the Audience Award. Stanfield says he was deeply moved by seeing the Warner family reunited and knowing that his work can help others.
Unfortunately, by and large, those people remain voiceless, which is why I think it's important for us on the outside to continue to have a voice for them. And when we are in the opportunity in a space where we can use it, that we use it, because they can't always speak and they don't have those rights available to them. So it's up to us to continue the conversation for him.
Namdi Asomugha says he hopes this film spurs people to take action to right long-standing wrongs, including fighting for those wrongly in prison.
I think as we continue to find our ways to sort of highlight these sort of issues, whether it's through art or it's through any other means that you can, I think it can lead to action. You know, I think conversations do lead to action, and that's how you fix it.
Crown Heights also stars Natalie Paul, known for her work on Boardwalk Empire, The Deuce, and Power, as Colin Warner's wife Antoinette. It is directed by Matt Ruskin. Crown Heights is open in U.S. theaters and is rated R. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
Many thanks, everyone, for joining us today on International Edition right here on The Voice of America. Always good to have you with us. A reminder, the top world news is straight ahead, so we hope you'll stay tuned. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Greg Burns, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Friday.
Next, an international public service announcement by the United States government.
The United States is determined to disrupt the illicit flow of money from the trade of oil and trafficking of antiquities to the terrorist group Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, or ISIL. Toward this end, the U.S. Department of State's Rewards for Justice program is offering a reward of up to $5 million for information leading to the significant disruption of the sale and/or trade of oil and antiquities by, for, on behalf of, or to benefit ISIL. Through its illegal oil operations and trafficking in looted archaeological material from Syria and Iraq, ISIL has generated millions of dollars in hard currency, enabling it to brutalize and oppress innocent civilians. This is the first time the U.S. Secretary of State has authorized a Rewards for Justice offer for information that could be used to disrupt the sale or trade in oil and antiquities by or on behalf of a terrorist organization. Anyone with information on oil and antiquities trafficking that benefits ISIL can contact the Rewards for Justice office via the website at www.rewardsforjustice.net or by email at info@rewardsforjustice.net or by standard mail at Rewards for Justice, Washington, D.C., 20520-0303. USA. Individuals in North America can also call this phone number, 1-800-877-3927. All information will be kept strictly confidential. The Rewards for Justice program is administered by the U.S. Department of State's Bureau of Diplomatic Security. Since its inception in 1984, the program has paid in excess of $125 million to more than 80 people who provided actionable information that put terrorists behind bars or prevented acts of international terrorism worldwide. Follow us on Twitter at https://twitter.com/rewardsforjustice, as in the numeral 4.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States government.